2.03. Mondus Oculum, the jewel of the northern forges, most valued and most industrious of weapon shops. Greater even than the Olympica Fossae assembly yards, only Lucas Crom's Mondus Gamma facilities replicated the work of the fabricator Locum's mighty forge, but even his great forge could not match its output. Covering hundreds of thousands of square kilometers between the domed mountains of Tharsis Tholus and Ceraunius Tholus, Cain's forge complex was a magnificent, monstrous hinterland of hive smelteries, weapons shops, armories, refineries, ore silos, fabrication hangars, and industrial stacks. Numerous sub-hives, Uranius, Rabon, and Labatus being the greatest, towered over the production facilities, the sinks and towering hab blocks home to the millions of adepts, menials, laborers, and muscle that drove the machines of the Northern Forge. Like most forges of Mars, the iron-skinned manufactura of Mondus Gamma were geared for war. The conquest of the galaxy demanded weapons and ammunition in quantities unknown in earlier ages of the galaxy, and the hammer of beating iron and the milling of copper jackets was unceasing. In the collapsed caldera of Uranius Patera, gigantic Tsiolkovsky towers lifted thousands of cargo containers from the supply yards into fat-bellied mass conveyors in geosynchronous orbit, ready to be transported to war zones flung out across the Imperium. Each tower was like an impossibly thick, pollarded tree, yet rendered slender by their height as they vanished into the poisonous, striated clouds that pressed down on the forge. Both Mondus Oculum and Mondus Gamma in the south were facilities geared for war, but it was a specific branch of warriors to whom the industry of these forges was dedicated, the Astartes. Crafted within these forges were the guns and blades wielded by the Emperor's most terrifying warriors in the prosecution of his grand dream, fabricated by the most skilled adepts and warranted never to fail by the fabricator Locum himself. The battle plate of the Astartes was painstakingly wrought upon the anvils of master metalsmiths, augmented with the highest specifications of manual dexterity and tolerances. Bolt guns, las cannons, missile launchers, and every other weapon in the Astartes inventory was produced here, the martial power of the legions first taking shape in the sweating, red-lit halls of Mondus Oculum. Armored vehicles rumbled from assembly lines, housed in vast, vaulted hangars, and entire city-sized regions were dedicated to the production of unimaginable quantities of bolter ammunition. But Mondus Oculum did not simply gird the Astartes for war with weapons and armor. It was also a place where minds were honed. Astartes warriors, deemed to have an affinity with the mysteries of technology, were permitted to study the ways of the machine under the tutelage of its master adepts. Fabricator Locum Cain himself had trained the finest of them, Tekel of the Salamanders, Gebrin of the Iron Hands, and Polonin of the Ultramarines, warriors who would take what they had learned back to their legions and instruct their neophytes. Mondus Oculum, beloved of Mars, the jewel of the northern forges, most valued and most industrious of weapon shops, domain of the fabricator Locum of Mars, the man second only to the ruler of Mars himself, and, correctly, one of the few forges of Mars to have avoided outright collapse. Flanked by a chittering retinue of new spherically modified servitors with blank, golden face masks, harried calculus loci, and a number of specialized data scrubbers whose fear was evident in the harsh binary blurts of Kant passing between them, fabricator Locum Cain sought to stay calm by immersing himself in thoughts of the mundane as he passed beneath the gilded archway that led to the Armorium. Beyond his forge, events of a great and terrible nature were unfolding. But for now, for this moment, he concentrated on keeping the processes of his own forge working as normally as possible in the face of the devastation. The cavernous chamber beyond the arch was brightly lit, its roof hundreds of meters above him, and its far end lost to perspective. Loader servitors and whining elevators carried racks of Astartes battle plate, stacking them in metal-skinned containers arranged along the height of the walls and in long rows that stretched off into the distance. Hundreds of quality-checking adepts moved through the chamber, hard plugging in to each container and checking the measured readings of each suit of armor with previously inloaded specifications. Only rarely would armor produced at Mondus Oculum fail to meet Kane's necessarily high tolerances, an occasion that would result in a thorough investigation as to the cause of the defect. Such defects would not be replicated, and those whose laxity had allowed it in the first place would be punished. Only once every suit had been checked and certified battle-ready would it be shipped to Uranus Patera and the orbital elevators. Warranted never to fail was a promise Fabricator Locum Kane took seriously, even now. Especially now. Kane took a deep breath, inhaling and sorting the chemical scent of the air before turning to his Magos apprentice.
"Can you smell that, Lachine?"
"Indeed, my lord," replied Lachine,
using his flesh voice in emulation of his master. The boy's voice was nasal and unpleasant, and the sooner he was augmented with a vocalizer the better, thought Kane.
"Calcined aluminium oxide, a lapping powder that can reduce lapping and polishing time of armor by at least 20%, and which is particularly effective on hard materials, such as silicon and hardened steel. Also, microcrystalline wax and dilute acetic acid."
Kane shook his head and placed a hand on Lachine's shoulder. The boy was much shorter than Kane, and his demeanor entirely literal, a useful trait in an apprentice in terms of efficiency and work, but a frustrating one for conversation.
"No, Lachine. I mean what the smells represent."
"Represent? Query. I do not understand your contention that odor is a signifier."
"No. Then you are missing out, Lachine," said Kane. "You register the chemical components. I, on the other hand, register the emotional ones. To me, the gentle reassuring smell of lapping powder, polish, and oil represents stability and order. The certainty that we have played our part in ensuring that the Emperor's warriors are equipped for battle with the best armor and weapons we can provide."
"I see, my lord," said Lachine, but Kane knew he did not.
"At times such as this, I find such things a comfort," explained Kane. "A great factory, with the machinery all working and revolving with absolute and rhythmic regularity, and with its workers all driven by one impulse and moving in unison as though a constituent part of the mighty machine, is one of the most inspiring examples of directed force the galaxy knows. I have rarely seen the face of an adept in the action of creation that was not fine, never one which was not earnest and impressive."
Kane paused as a lifter servitor passed, carrying a rack of gleaming, freshly dipped suits of battle plate. The brutish monster was all muscles, pistons, and gene-bulked torso, and it effortlessly bore the heavy weight of the armor in its hydraulically clawed fists. Each suit shone silver, the metal and ceramite unpainted and left for each legion to adorn with its own colors.
"Like knights from a bygone age of terror," said Kane,
setting off along the serried ranks of thousands upon thousands of suits of armor contained within the chamber.
"A byword for honor, duty, and courage."
"My lord?"
Kane gestured towards the armor with a dramatic sweep of his hand.
"This armor is a resource more precious than the wealth of worlds, Lachine. On most days it gives me great satisfaction to know how much the Astartes depend on us. I can normally lose myself in this place."
He saw Lachine about to speak and said,
"Not literally, of course. I look at the sheer volume of armor stored here, and, even though none of these suits are occupied by one of the Emperor's finest, I am still awed by the power of the Astartes and take solace that we are protected by such awesome heroes."
"Conclusion. Your words lead me to infer that on this day you do not take the same satisfaction you would normally."
"Indeed I do not, Lachine. Despite my attempts to immerse myself in the daily tasks of the Forge, I find my thoughts returning to the chaos that has engulfed our beloved world over the last few weeks."
Beginning on the day the freakish and unnatural storms had broken over the faraway peak of Olympus Mons, and the devastating machine plague had wreaked havoc across Mars, an epidemic of riots, suicides, and murders had swept through Mondus Oculum, claiming thousands of lives and, more importantly, doing untold damage to the production facilities. Scores of factories and weapon shops had been destroyed, burned to the ground or smashed beyond repair in the whipping, shuddering waves of panic and psychosis that had swept through the Habs and factories like contagious lunacy. The forge marshals had been unable to cope with the paroxysms of violence, and, though it pained him to do so, Kane had ordered them to withdraw and allow the rioters to run their course.
Who would have thought such trouble could have been touched off by a freak weather system over 3,000 kilometers away? He said.
Studies by Magos Kantor have shown that uncomfortable cold weather can stimulate aggressiveness and a willingness to take risks, while apathy prevails in the heat, said Lachine. Additional, temperature has previously been shown to affect mood, which in turn affects behavior. With higher temperature or barometric pressure related to higher mood, better memory, and broadened cognitive style. Humidity, temperature, and hours of exposure to sunshine have the greatest effect on mood, though Kantor believes humidity to be the most significant predictor in regression and canonical correlation analysis. Implications for the climate control of forges and subsequent worker performance are discussed in detail in the study's conclusion. Would you like me to summarize them?
In the name of the Omnisire, please don't, said Kane, striding onwards into the depths of the Armorium.
Lachine and his retinue struggled to match his long, purposeful stride. As the panting Lachine drew alongside him, Kane said,
Certainly. It's absurd to believe that a meteorological phenomenon, even one so fierce, could affect the psyches of so many. Yet, the evidence before us is hard to ignore. However, the damage was not restricted to just the cognitive processes of the Forge's population.
That fact troubled him more than any other. As the storm raged over Olympus Mons, the vox lines and data highways of Mars had swarmed with screaming, shrieking packets of corrupted data that sliced into the delicate systems that governed almost every aspect of the workings of Mondus Oculum. The outlying forge cogitators and logic engines had clogged with corrupt data, howling ghosts of sourceless machine noise and dangerous code packets of infected algorithms that many of the most advanced Aegis protocols were helpless to defeat.
Only Kane's swift action to shut down the I.O. highways and the fact that the vast majority of his systems had recently been upgraded to take advantage of Coriolzus's revolutionary system of neuspheric data transference had spared them the worst of the attack, for an attack it surely had been.
How much longer do the code scrubbers need before they will have my system cleaned out? He asked.
Current estimates range from 6 full rotations to 30.
That's a wide range. Can't they narrow their estimation?
Apparently the corrupt code is proving to be most resilient to their efforts, explained Lachine. Each portion of circuitry that is certified purged soon develops faulty lines of code at a geometric rate once again. They dare not reconnect any system touched by the polluted algorithms for fear of reinfection.
Have they identified its point of origin?
Not with any certainty, though the infection of systems appears to be spreading outwards from the forge of the Fabricator General, suggesting that it was the first to suffer.
Or where it was released, muttered Kane.
Despite repeated attempts to communicate with Kelbor Hal, every transmission had been rebuffed by squalling code screams like barking dogs, or was simply ignored.
Query, you believe this scrap code to have been released into the Martian systems on purpose?
Even the normally logical and literal Lachine could not keep an emotional response from his voice at the notion that the scrap code had been unleashed deliberately. Kane cursed himself for his verbal slip and shrugged.
It's a possibility, he admitted, keeping his tone light. He didn't particularly want to voice his suspicions to Lachine.
His apprentice was loyal, but he was naive, and Kane knew that information could be thieved by any number of means from supposedly secure sources. No, the less Lachine knew of Kane's suspicions, the better. According to the code scrubbers, the scrap code had attempted to shut down the Vox network and defense protocols that protected his forge, and then released the tension in the Cholkovsky Tower's guy wires. Kane had shut off the links between Mondus Oculum and the rest of Mars in an instant, leaving them floundering in the dark, but safe from further attack. Even communications off-world had become next to impossible thanks to a sourceless backwash of psychic interference. Kane had only been able to maintain contact between the forge of Epluvium Maximal and the magma city of Adept Zeth thanks to the new sphere. The news coming from both was neither reassuring nor particularly illuminating. Both adepts had suffered similar outbreaks of inexplicable violence and madness among their populace, though only Maximal had experienced serious machine failures, losing three of his prized reactors to critical mass overloads. Zeth had spoken of a failed experiment that had seen virtually all of her psychers dead, no doubt related to the psychic interference surrounding Mars. As if things weren't bad enough, Maximal went on to tell of fragmentary communications he had inloaded from the expedition fleets that spoke of an equally terrible catastrophe in the Istvan system. Details were sketchy, and Maximal had not wanted to speculate without firmer information, but it appeared that a dreadful incident had occurred around the third planet, which was now said to be a blasted, ashen wasteland. Kane knew of only one weapon that could reduce a planet to such a wretched, hellish state in so short a time. Had the Warmaster unleashed the Life Eater, or was this the desperate last act of a defeated foe? Maximal's sources had no answer to that, but claimed that the Astartes had taken fearful casualties. Whether they had suffered as a result of enemy action or a terrible accident of friendly fire was unclear, but for Astartes to suffer any loss on such a scale was almost impossible to imagine. Of all of them, Maximal's Vox systems had suffered least in the deluge of unclean code, and he was even now attempting to restore communications with agencies beyond the surface of Mars for further information. Via secure noospheric links, all three adepts expressed their certainty that the infection of the Martian systems bore all the hallmarks of a preemptive strike. But without more solid data, there was nothing they could do but strengthen their defenses in case of further assault. Kane had heard the fear in Maximal's ridiculously rarefied voice and despised him for it. Maximal was not an easy adept to like, and Kane considered him to be little more than an archivist rather than an innovator. Coriel Zeth, on the other hand, had spoken boldly of resisting any follow-up attacks and of how she had dispatched envoys to allied warrior orders of titans and knights to secure their assistance. With Mars under attack from an unknown foe, it was time to gather one's friends close. Kane respected Zeth, for she reminded him of a younger version of himself, an adept unafraid to push the boundaries of the known. To Kane, Zeth represented all that was good about the Mechanicum, an adept who possessed a proper reverence for the past and what earlier pioneers had developed that meshed with an unashamed hunger to build upon that knowledge to reach still greater heights. An ancient alchemist and scientist of Terra had once said that he had seen further by standing on the shoulders of giants. That perfectly applied to Adept Zeth, and Kane knew that if anyone was going to advance the cause of science and reason in the Imperium, it was her. Emboldened by that thought, Kane watched as huge tracked haulers lifted sealed containers of Astartes weapons and armor for transport to the orbital elevators of Uranius Patera. "Come, Lachine," he said. "Even during a crisis, the work of Mondus Oculum must continue." Grey dust, like ashen bone, billowed around the legs of the two knights as they loped along the edges of the Aghanip Fossae, the long trench that carved into the plains west of the towering form of Asaya Mons. Leopold Cronus led the way in Pax Mortis, with Raff Maven following behind in the newly repaired Equitos Bellum. Cronus set a brisk striding pace, and Maven had to work hard to keep up with him, for Equitos Bellum was skittish, its controls tight, and the manifold willfully resisted him at every turn. "It knows the thing that hurt it is still out there," thought Maven, angling his course to follow Cronus and the deep canyon. Dust clouds obscured the view from his cockpit, but there was little to see in this region, and he was piloting via the manifold anyway. The toxic deserts of the Pallidus stretched out to the west and south, and the northern subhives between here and Epluvian Maximal's forge were little more than black smudges of hanging smoke and fear to the north. The knights followed the course of the chasm towards the median bridge, a section of collapsed rock where they could cross before turning eastwards towards their chapter house within the Arsaya Chasmata.
"How's it doing?"
asked Cronus over the Voxlink.
"It's hard work," admitted Maven. "It keeps pulling at the controls, but there's no sense to it. Each time I compensate, it returns on the opposite side a moment later." "It will take time to readjust," said Cronus. "The entire link assembly had to be rebuilt."
"I know, but it feels stronger than that."
"Stronger how? What do you mean?"
"Like it's trying to guide me," said Maven, at a loss how else to explain it.
"Guide you? To where?"
I don't know. But it's like... like something's pulling at me, too.
Maven heard Cronus sigh over the vox and wished he had something more solid to offer his friend by way of an explanation. All he had was a gut feeling and the firmly held conviction that his mount knew better than he what needed to be done. Their deployment had begun 3 days ago, when they left the chapter house in a fanfare of cheers, squires' trumpets, blaring war horns, and waving cobalt banners. Equitos Bellum marched out, and the brothers of the Knights of Taranis had come to watch it walk once more. For a mount to have returned from the verge of destruction was no small matter, and the occasion had to be marked. Like most of the warrior orders of Tharsis, the Knights of Taranis had been on high alert since the chaos that had engulfed Mars began. Thanks to the new spheric links installed by Adept Zeth, the halls of Taranis had not suffered as horrifically as many others had, though the engine seers had been forced to order an emergency shutdown of the chapter house's main reactor after a fragment of scrap code attempted to disengage its coolant protocols. That speedy response had saved the Order of Taranis from a nuclear holocaust, but until the code scrubbers could purge the corrupted systems, those night machines without full power cells would not be able to recharge. Nor had that been the worst of the damage. Much to Lord Verticorda's anguish, the data looms of the Order's librarium had been corrupted beyond repair, taking with them a roll of honor and battle stretching back 1,000 years and more. At the request of Adept Zeth, Lords Catarix and Verticorda had ordered the Knights of Taranis to ride from their chapter house in defense of Mars and the Magma City. Rumor had it that Zeth had also dispatched emissaries to Lord Cavallario of Tempestus to petition their engines to walk, but no one knew what answer she had received. With several machines powerless to ride until the reactor was repaired, the Knights of Taranis were forced to operate in teams of 2 instead of 3 to cover the scale of their deployment. Old Stater had marched out alongside Brother Gentron, a rider newly elevated from the errantry, and Maven had been surprised to find that he missed the flinty presence of his preceptor. Maven and Cronus had ridden east, following a patrol circuit that carried them clockwise around the rumpled skirts of the ancient volcano, before turning to follow the line of the Oti Fossae southwards. As night fell on the second day of their ride, they turned west towards the Magma City to refuel and recharge before continuing on their patrol circuit. The forge of Coriel Zeth never failed to amaze Maven. Glowing like an ember in the distance, while the skies above seethed with orange light, as though the clouds themselves were afire. Riding closer, lava-filled aqueducts had shone like threads of gold as they carried molten rock from the top of Etna's dam, the monolithic structure that formed the entirety of the volcano's southern flank, to the magma lagoon surrounding the city. Towering walls of ceramite and adamantium ringed the enormous city, and the light of the planet's lifeblood dispelled the darkness as the knights marched along the mighty, statue-lined Typhon causeway towards the Vulcan Gate. Silver and black spires jutted over the walls like metallic teeth, and only after convoluted binaric interrogation by the gate's defenses had they been allowed inside. They had stayed within the circuit of the walls just long enough for their mount's power cells to be brought back to maximum charge before riding out. The two knights had continued on their patrol circuit of the enormous volcano, skirting the Magma City's port facilities where millions of tons of war material was ferried into the hungry bellies of mass conveyors hanging low in the crowded skies. No sooner had they left the smoking grandeur of Zeth City than Maven had felt Equitos Bellum pulling at him, an insistent urge that nagged at his hindbrain and sent painful skewers of pain into his mind whenever he resisted. With their course soon to carry them eastwards towards home, the pull was getting stronger, and Maven gripped the controls tighter as he felt a building ache behind his eyes. He felt every one of his hard plugs scratching with irritation, as though Equitos Bellum was trying to dislodge him like a wild colt. "What's the matter with you?" he hissed. As if in answer, a ghostly flare on the Auspex spiked to the south, and Maven flinched as a surge of recognition pulsed in his mind. The image vanished almost as soon as it appeared, and he wasn't even sure he'd seen it. But for the briefest instant, it had looked like a dreadfully familiar spider-like pattern of electromagnetic energy. Maven drew his mount to a halt, feeling the pain behind his eyes ease as he did so. The tall machine's hydraulics hissed as it sank down onto its haunches.
"Cronus, wait!" he called,
rotating the knight's upper body with a deft movement of the controls. There was nothing to see here, just bone-white ash and dust whipped in from the southern Pallidus. He heard the relaxing groan of metal as Equitos Bellum settled, feeling the tension in his limbs and the restless hunger for vengeance burning in its core.
"What is it?" replied Cronus,
and Maven read the telltales of his brother's machine assuming a war posture through the manifold.
"What do you see?"
"I don't know," admitted Maven.
"I don't think there's actually anything out there, but Equitos Bellum's got the scent of something." "Did you get an Orspec's return?"
"Sort of. Maybe. I don't know," said Maven. "It was like a ghost image or something. It was just like the energy signature I saw right before the attack on Maximal's reactor."
Pax Mortis rode alongside him, and Maven could see Leopold Cronus through the armor glass canopy. His brother looked unconvinced, but not yet ready to write off Maven's and Equitos Bellum's instincts for danger.
"Send it over," ordered Cronus. "The Orspec's log for the last few minutes."
Maven nodded, exloading the data from his Orspec's panel to Cronus's machine in a brief data squirt. As he waited for Cronus to review the data, he cast his gaze out into the depths of the Pallidus. The ashen deserts were desolate and uninhabitable, a landscape of tortured grandeur, rendered barren and toxic by rapacious overmining and unthinking plundering of the resources buried beneath the Martian soil. Pollutants blown in from the equatorial refinery belt carpeted the barren, scarred rock, making it a treacherous landscape of sand-covered crevices and sinkholes. Nothing lived in the Pallidus, yet Maven found himself unaccountably drawn to grip the controls of his mount and ride south into the wasteland. His power cells were fully charged, and he had more than enough reserves of nutrients and water to last him for weeks, if need be. His hands twitched at the controls, and he felt the heart of his mount respond to his desire. It goaded him with warlike whispers and an insistent pressure at the back of his mind. His lip curled into a snarl as he thought of hunting the monstrous, dead thing that had almost killed him. It was out there, and Equitos Bellum knew it. He could feel the certainty of that fact in every molecule of his being. The ghost image had been a reminder of his duty to his mount.
"There's nothing here,"
said Cronus, breaking into his thoughts.
"Orspec's track is clean."
"I know," said Maven, with calm, cold certainty. "There's nothing nearby."
"Then why have we stopped?"
"Because Equitos Bellum is telling me where I need to go."
"Go?"
asked Cronus.
"What are you talking about? The only place we need to go is across the Medium Bridge and back to the Chapter House."
"No,"
insisted Maven.
"It's out there. The thing that tried to kill us. It's in the south. I know it."
"How can you know it?"
demanded Cronus.
"There's nothing on the Orspec's. You said so yourself."
"I know that, Leo. But I saw what I saw. Equitos Bellum can feel it, and I trust its instincts."
"And what? You're going to go after it on your own?"
"If I have to," said Maven.
"Don't be foolish," warned Cronus. "Catarix will have your spurs if you do this."
"He can have them,"
said Maven, powering up and raising the knight to its full height once more.
"I need to do this. Equitos Bellum needs this if it's ever going to be whole again." "You're willing to risk your spurs by going off mission on what, a hunch?"
"It's more than that, Leo," said Maven.
"I know it's out there, and I'm going after it, whether you like it or not."
Once again, Maven heard Cronus sigh, and though he hated to abandon his friend, he knew he had no choice. Equitos Bellum would give him no peace until they had been avenged.
"Very well,"
said Cronus.
"Where is it? Give me a heading."
"Leo, you're coming with me?"
asked Maven.
"This thing, whatever it is, already got the better of you once before,"
said Cronus.
"So logically, you're going to need my help if you're going to take it on again."
"You're a true friend,"
said Maven, so very proud of his brother.
"Shut up, and let's go before I see sense and change my mind."
Maven smiled.
"Follow me,"
he said, turning his mount and riding into the Paladus. The hunt was on, and Equitos Bellum surged with wounded pride. Maven welcomed it. Dahlia awoke with a scream, her hand clutching her chest, hyperventilating as the fragments of the darkness within her skull threatened to spill out and consume her. Serpentine shapes lurked in the shadows, and Dahlia hugged the sheets close to her body as she heard the hiss of a draconic breath drawn at the beginning of the universe and saw the gleam of teeth in ever-widening jaws. A voice in the darkness spoke her name. Even with her eyes shut, she could see him. The hooded man with the wild eyes and the mark of the dragon burning beneath his skin. Its silver fire was a web of light within his flesh. She forced her eyes open as the light levels in the hab grew from nightlight to full illumination. Beside her, Caxton stirred, half asleep as he fumbled with the lumen controls.
What's the matter?
He asked, groggily. Dahlia's eyes flickered to the corners of the hab, where, of course, there were no serpentine predators lurking in the shadows to devour her, and no hooded man with glittering mercury for blood. She saw a gunmetal grey footlocker overflowing with clothing, the small table strewn with machine parts, and oil-stained walls hung with thin sheets of paper covered in scrawled diagrams. A dripping tap echoed in the ablutions cubicle, and an uneaten meal lay in its foil wrapper next to an empty water bottle. She focused on those simple, domestic items. Their familiarity an anchor to the real world, and not the realm of dreams and nightmares, the world of dragons and hooded men.
Are you all right?
Asked Caxton, sitting up in bed and putting his arm around her. The haptic implants in his fingertips were cold against her bare skin, and she shivered. He mistook it for fear and pulled her close.
I'm here, Dahlia. There's nothing to worry about. You just had a nightmare.
Ever since waking from her coma, Dahlia had discovered that she could not bear to be alone. Sleep would not come, and a gnawing terror of sinking down into darkness for all eternity would open like a yawning chasm of emptiness within her. She feared she might never emerge from it, should she fall in. When she had confided this to Caxton, he had offered to stay with her, and though she recognized male desire in the offer, she recognized her own need as well. His moving into her hab unit had seemed like the most natural thing in the world. They sat there for several minutes, Caxton rocking her gently, and Dahlia letting him.
Was it the same as before?
He asked. She nodded.
The dragon and the hooded man.
Every night the same dream,
he said in wonder.
What do you think it means?
Dahlia pulled free from his embrace and turned her head to look directly at him.
It means we need to leave.
I'll wake the others,
he said, seeing the determination in her eyes. She leaned in and kissed him.
Do it quickly, she said.